RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
All right, time for our Legal Hub Wednesday morning here at RCR. And the freedom of speech repercussions of making tikanga a compulsory subject in legal education. Joining us is Thomas Newman from the Free Speech Union, currently supporting Gary Judd, King's Counsel, KC, who has a complaint against a compulsory tikanga Māori course for law students. Thomas will be delivering an oral submission to the Regulations Review Committee at Parliament on the 16th of October, so in just a day or so. Thomas, thank you for coming on to RCR Legal Hub this morning.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, this creep of tikanga into what is, I guess, the New Zealand legal system, and the way it's sort of snuck in. How would you describe the way it's snuck in? It's political, isn't it? Is it anything more than that? It's a kind of ideological? Take it from there.
It's a very good question. How has it sort of crept into our legal ecosystem? I consider it sort of broader than just the legal system per se, the formal part of it. It's a much broader cultural phenomenon. I think the simplest way to put it is that this is a manifestation of a kind of march through or long march through the institutions. I use that phrase advisedly. Very recently, I read a piece that was published by Warren Pike, who's a fairly senior, mostly criminal defence lawyer, I understand, based in Auckland. He published a piece in the Law News, which is a publication of the Law Association. That's kind of like the primary competitor for the Law Society in terms of membership and representation functions. His piece was basically a summary and a reflection on a speech or a presentation made by Supreme Court Justice Joe Williams late last year at a seminar conference in Waitangi. That was titled Negotiating Power Across the Void. And in that address, Justice Williams, he quoted a passage from the writings of notorious Marxian philosopher Antonio Gramsci. Now, Antonio Gramsci didn't give this name of the long march through the institution to his ideas. That was something that was done later. But he's certainly the genesis for that concept, basically the idea of, you know, engaging in collective action over a very long time, capturing strategic places in core institutions like universities, etc., in order to push some kind of political goal, in the case of Marxism, socialism or communism or some variant of that. And my personal opinion is that this is exactly an example of that phenomenon here in New Zealand, just with respect to tikanga, Maori culture and sort of related sort of things.
So judges are going along with tikanga being some kind of first law, that it was here before anything else was here. That's the impression I've got from reading the material. And because of that,
yes,
that its status is somehow sort of enshrined somewhere. I mean, tikanga was never a legal system. It was more just ways of defining patterns of behaviour in certain situations, wasn't it? I mean, that's not a legal system as such, is it?
Yes. I'm just trying to think who I was talking to over the weekend, but we sort of shared our scepticism that tikanga as such actually existed at the time of the signing of the treaty in the way that it's said to exist now as a kind of more or less coherent, interconnected body of norms and values. But yes, in the 2022 Supreme Court decision in the Ellis case about whether his conviction appeal should continue, the Supreme Court took it upon itself, or some, a portion of the Supreme Court judges took it upon themselves to take the opportunity, or rather manufacture the opportunity, to make a declaration that tikanga is the first law of New Zealand. I don't know this for a fact, but I'm fairly well certain that it was Justice Susan Glazebrook who prompted the lawyers appearing in that case to go away and consider how tikanga might be relevant. So what they did was they went and they had a wānanga with some essentially cultural experts. Amongst them, this is a fairly famous name, but Sir Hiradi Moko Mead. The result of that was this statement of tikanga that was filed with the Supreme Court. And that's what the Supreme Court relied upon when making this declaration that tikanga was the first law of New Zealand. Now, just to take a moment to dwell upon that, that name, Justice Susan Glazebrook. She's another one of these quite obviously activist judges who is not just complicit, but really pushing the tikanga agenda. Like I say, I don't know for certain that she was the one who asked the question of the lawyers in the case what the tikanga perspective on the issue was, but I'm fairly confident that it is her. And I'm fortified in that because she's given public speeches basically about explicitly about decolonization and indigenization of, in particular, New Zealand's legal education curriculum. There's a speech that's published on the Courts of New Zealand website, which is basically all about this. So it's not hidden. It might be sort of under the radar in the sense that it's slipping by with few people paying attention, but the people involved, including some of the most senior judges in our country, are definitely not just a part of this, but pushing it quite aggressively.
So what does it mean for legal decisions? Let's say tikanga was full noise, part of the legal ecosystem, as you put it. And we know about the Ellis case, and he wasn't even Māori, right? Okay, so you don't need even be Māori to have it applied to you or your case. I mean, how could the common law basis of our legal system, and I know that the compulsory law degree subjects are the legal system, the law of contracts, the law of torts, criminal law, public law, and property law. So tikanga is in there. I'm just trying to imagine how that would affect outcomes and legal decisions, because you could argue that it might let, or it might be more sympathetic to offenders if the sort of woolly concept of tikanga was applied. I mean, I can't sort of bring it into any more detail than that, my thinking here, but that's the feeling you get, that it would not be so reliable, let's say, as a way of judging cases. Or certain, exactly.
Yes. Yeah. I completely agree. And I think that is one of the likely major effects of the greater incorporation of tikanga into legal processes and legal decision-making. I mean, the Supreme Court acknowledged itself that, basically tikanga is more, the way they put it was that it's more context sensitive than common law, and basically permits more variation depending on circumstance. And one of the other kind of practical factors is that it's not just circumstance, but it also varies depending on place, or to be a little bit more cynical, who you ask, which iwi, which authority, which expert or tohunga. And so the introduction of these woolly concepts, which are not really that well defined, will increase uncertainty in legal processes and outcomes. It's already kind of having that effect, because tikanga, I mean, it's not like it's been entirely absent from our legal system. It does have something of a pedigree going, all the way back to the likes of, the 1860s, but mostly just as an acknowledgement that, tikanga is the customs or the customary values and practices of one part of our population. But because it's being relied upon more, it's being incorporated more, but the concepts are not really that well defined. So the results that we get are the likes of the Smith and Fonterra case, where the Supreme Court said, hey, look, let's not be, too hasty here in striking out this complaint. Tikanga might have something to say about the impacts of climate change on the kaitiaki tanga of some Maori person with an interest in land or similar. So now we've got this huge case, which is going to take years and years, costing hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars, where the Supreme Court's basically left it up to this process to figure out what exactly tikanga means, how it might affect the outcome. That's a major impact. There are some other cases, including criminal law, where it's been incorporated. And I suppose that you can be fairly certain what the effect there will be. I forget the name of the case. It might have been something like Green and the Crown, where there was a chap from Rotorua who appealed a decision declining him a discharge without conviction. I can't remember the offence. This is quite a recent decision, but basically he appealed on the basis that having a conviction would affect his mana, and that for various reasons of tikanga, he should be able to have this discharge without conviction, and that's what happened in the result. So we can be fairly certain that wherever it's invoked in criminal law, it's likely to lend towards a more permissive, more lenient treatment of an offender.
Isn't that the whole point, to have your mana hit when you've done something wrong? Isn't that the deterrent?
I think so too, and I'm probably a little bit unusual in that respect. As I was formerly a full-time criminal defence lawyer for about 5 years, but
right.
I'm no sympathiser to bad behaviour and excusing and enabling it. So, a hit to mana, I think, is precisely.
That's the whole point. All right, judges effectively changing the law.
Or evolving it, as they would say.
Evolving it, but it's changing it really, isn't it, from what we've known?
Yes.
And Parliament's sovereign, isn't it? So all this has
well,
to be done.
What you're told.
Well, yeah, sometimes I wonder as well. But it's not up to judges to make these calls in any way, is it? At all, they're way outside their brief.
Yes, and that's where a sort of one of these core battle lines within the broader debate is drawn. What's happening here? Is this an organic evolution of the common law? If it is, well, you know, that's something that has always taken place, including over centuries in England and the United Kingdom, where we get our common law from. That's legitimate. So if it's that, then, hey, maybe it's fine. If, on the other hand, it's judicial activism, then that's illegitimate, because what's happening there is, rather than basically judges sort of observing how society develops, how its values and practices develop, and trying to mould the contours of the common law to cohere with the values and practices of society, it's actually basically a cultural elite pushing something on people and contriving the change through the use of their authority. I think it's the latter. And to the extent that it's the latter, it's illegitimate, because it's something that people wouldn't consent to if they felt free to dissent and to push back against it, or if they, they knew what was happening. And I think, unfortunately, this is one of these things that tends to go unnoticed.
Now, if this was compulsory for law students, over time, that would change the legal ecosystem just through that, wouldn't it? Because you'd just have just
precisely
a quantum. So you wouldn't recognise it probably in 20 years.
I personally think that that is precisely the point. So the core claim made by the supporters of this tikanga regulation, its compulsory inclusion in legal education from next year, is that basically it's got to the point now where tikanga is inescapably relevant to legal practice. And they cite things like the Ellis Continuance decision, where this declaration was made, that's the first law of New Zealand. They point to all these places in statutes where tikanga is expressly incorporated, such as in the Resource Management Act and other places. And they say, like, oh, look, it's been in cases all the way back to 1860 and sort of fairly consistently throughout our legal history. So it's just inescapably relevant. And to the extent that it's inescapably relevant, well, God, we'd be negligent if we weren't teaching our law students. I think that's wrong. I think that's, the way that the likes of the Law Society and the Council for Legal Education have painted the picture, you might be left with the impression that that's true. But if you take a close look at the way that the decision in the Ellis Continuance case, the way that that decision was actually crafted, the Supreme Court actually says a number of very important things. One, tikanga will not need to be considered where it is not relevant. They don't give us any further guidance on that, but they do make that point. Two, It cannot change the common law. It cannot override statute. So if there's some kind of clear statutory provision which might clash with tikanga, statute prevails. It also can't change binding precedent. So it can't change the common law if there's a settled precedent that goes against it. So that begs the question, well, okay, it seems like tikanga is practically inert, except when perhaps activist judges want to insert it into some opening. If that's the case, then, well, because it can't affect outcomes, how is it relevant? When the answer to that question, I think, is, well, it's not. And as to this point about, it having been incorporated by Parliament into various statutes, there's an equally valid and I think more valid point straight back to that, which is that, well, yes, it's been incorporated into some statutes, but you could look at any number of statutes on the statute books and the word's entirely absent. In my written submissions to the Regulations Review Committee, I think I identified maybe 19 or 20 different statutes or pieces of legislation where the word doesn't appear even once. And that includes things like the Senior Courts Acts, all of the rules of the different courts, like the High Court rules and the Court of Appeal rules, the Supreme Court rules, and various other pieces of legislation. So it suggests that really this picture that the likes of the Law Society and the Council of Legal Education are attempting to paint actually is false and misrepresents the reality, which is that, again, tikanga is almost entirely irrelevant to almost the whole of the practice of law. Now, it's true that there will be some areas where it's relevant, such as over practitioners who are appearing before the Waitangi Tribunal and others, but the next question then becomes, well, does this need to be forced on everyone in order for those people to be competent when dealing with those issues? And I think the simple answer to that is no.
Yeah, it might stop really smart legal minds entering the field, actually. So limiting the talent, because no one likes to have stuff shoved down their throat. I mean, look at what happened with the real estate people and the compulsory Māori course and that. Great performing real estate agents who've been selling houses for 30, 40 years, just, disposable in the face of that, which makes no sense at all.
And I've had very senior legal practitioners say to me something to the effect that, look, if I'm required to do, some continuing professional development course on tikanga and the law and how it's relevant, then bother it. I'm just not going to renew my practicing certificate because this is rubbish. Now, I mean, at this stage, that's not being proposed. It's not proposed that lawyers be subject to the same sort of thing that real estate agents
No, but you know what the creep is like, though? What happens? It creeps in.
Well, I think exactly. And so, look, I wouldn't be surprised if within maybe, well, between 1 year's and 5 years' time, some move is made to make a CPD requirement. And in some fairly heated online arguments that I've had, and one in particular I'm thinking of with a fairly vocal academic, certainly he thought it would be interesting and fun from his perspective to basically require lawyers to do some kind of course. The impression I got was that it wasn't really because he thought that, it was relevant and that people needed to learn the stuff for, to be competent. But because basically he thought it would be funny to sort of troll professional people in that way. So, the will is there. And so I wouldn't be surprised if in some short period of time we're seeing that sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay. So you're making an oral submission, day and a half away as it is at the moment. Is this one of these you've only got 5 minutes to speak jobs or what?
I've only been given 5 minutes, which what little I understand about select committee hearings, I'm told that that's quite short. That's okay. I prepared a brief speech, which, if anything, the time constraints have made the message better by making it punchier and more direct. So I'll be delivering that on Wednesday. Gary has 15 minutes, as I recall it, and then following me, the New Zealand Council for Legal Education, who's passed this regulation and who are effectively the respondents, they have about 15 minutes after me.
So they have to plead their case, do they? You can imagine what that's going to be like.
Yes, they do have to plead their case. They've filed two sets of submissions, like both Gary and I. And basically, I mean, the points that they make are that, look, this, like, in essence, their position is Tikanga has become inescapably relevant to legal practice. It's incorporated into so many areas, and the Supreme Court said that it's the first law of New Zealand. You know, you can criticise this stuff if you want to, that's your right. But, you know, given our regulatory role, we simply can't ignore it.
Oh, really?
yeah, that's the stance that they've taken publicly. The name that's been put to the submissions that have been filed is that of Mr. Neil Campbell, who's a High Court judge in Auckland. I've got no reason to believe that he in particular is any kind of activist. And if you go through the names that make up the Council of Legal Education, there's a number of people there that, you know, you'd look at and you wouldn't think anything of. But as a whole, I'm sceptical about the council's disclaiming any activist intent. Certainly there are, you know, there's a small number of people that you could readily identify as activists, including the likes of Dean of Law at AUT, Kylie Quince.
We keep hearing that name.
Statement about how Gary should go die in a corner.
The dinosaur, yeah.
Yes, and another that springs to mind is, I would describe her as an activist barrister, Natalie Coates. She is formerly of a firm called Kahui Legal. She's recently joined, I think, Thorndon Chambers in Wellington, but she was, I think, possibly lead counsel on the Smith and Fonterra case.
Right.
And has been one of these lawyers that has popped up consistently as pushing, you know, the relevance of tikanga in various cases. And she's also said some very critical things of the likes of David Seymour and the Treaty Principles Bill. So these are the sorts of people, or some of the people, that make up the Council for Legal Education.
Really interesting, Thomas. Well, let's hear what you have to say on Wednesday, and maybe we can get back and follow that up and see how that went down and where this leaves us on tikanga. Got a feeling, though, that they'll hit a brick wall on this, but I could be wrong. What do I know? What's your feeling in the end?
About the likely outcome?
Yeah, you know, you can push it so far, but
it's a good question. I suppose if I was a betting man, I'd say that it's probably more likely than not that this will be allowed to slip through. I think that the National Party doesn't really have an appetite for making bold principled decisions. I could be wrong about that. And I think that, well, I'd add one caveat. I think there's a real chance that it'll slip through and this will go ahead next year, unless the voting public make it very clear what their views on this are. So to all of those listeners out there who, you know, are worried about this, you know, specifically for lawyers, but about this phenomenon generally, if you want the government to make the right decision, then I'd encourage you to get in touch with the likes of Paul Goldsmith, who's the Minister of Justice, and members from, you know, the minor party coalition partners in New Zealand First and ACT. If the coalition government can see that this is something that the public demands action on, then I think there's enough alignment there on the principles that the government can be trusted to take the action, but not without it. So that's the one caveat I'd put on that. So we'll see how we go after Wednesday.
Okay, Thomas Newman, Free Speech Union, currently supporting Gary Judd, King's Counsel, who has the complaint against a compulsory tikanga Māori course for law students. Thanks for coming on, Thomas. Really interesting.
Real pleasure.
Let's see how it goes, all right? Okay.
Thanks for having me on, Paul.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.